Hi, this is Austin Hill. Hey, thanks for checking out this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. Now, you can hear our program live weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time. There are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows. They're available online. Our web address, of course, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Hey, good morning, 6:04. Welcome to it. Thursday underway. It's the Faith Radio Network, and I am Austin Hill. I'm here weekday morning, 6 till 8, where we seek to be informative and challenging, hopeful and helpful as you get your day started. And we've got some great folks to talk with later this morning that will help you do just that. Leslie Vernick, a counselor extraordinaire, has some tremendous relationship advice for us coming up just about half an hour from now at How's This for a Title. She's written about this. Dr. Leslie Vernick written about this just recently. And her latest blog piece is entitled, Help, I'm a Peace Faker. Not a peacemaker, but a peace faker, F-A-K-E-R. Okay, well, we know from scriptural truth, and Jesus taught this in the Beatitudes, is specifically the portion of the New Testament where this is recorded, but he said, blessed are the peacemakers. And peacemaking has been something that's been hot in the list of topics that I believe the Christian community across the country and really Americans all over the U.S. are talking about and thinking about, in as much as we have this on the global scale, we've got this call to action, even if in the SRN newscast that you heard there just moments ago at the top of the hour on our affiliates, there is more discussion of even more intervention from the U.S. military in the Middle East in an effort to make peace. I have, over the years, as I've contemplated Jesus' teaching about blessed are the peacemakers, I've come to the conclusion that peacemaking and peacekeeping are not the same thing. And sometimes peacekeeping has to be set aside for a moment, so some things can change in the effort to make peace, to be a peacemaker. Now Leslie Vernick, speaker, author, and licensed clinical counselor, she's going to weigh in on people who are just kind of faking it, maintaining some sort of peace, false peace, if you will, in a relationship when it's not genuine. So looking forward to talking with Leslie Vernick coming up in just about half an hour from now. Also, into the 7 o'clock hour, you'll meet a gentleman named Daniel Ray Day. He's a Nashville area author. And he has launched this book and started this movement called 10 Days Without. 10 Days Without. Well, 10 Days Without what? Well, he says he was tired of just saying he was a Christian and wanted to live it out and to do without certain sorts of basic sustenance things. And you might be surprised what 10 Days Without implies. But you want to put his faith to the test, I guess you could say. So Daniel Ray Day, the 10 Days Without guy, he joins us into the 7 o'clock hour. Now, in just about 2 minutes, our good friend David Smith from Smith Investment Management, he'll join us. And David Smith, he was with us last week. Do you realize just in the last week or so, we have seen new highs on Wall Street? I mean, the stock market is performing really, really well, despite all the turmoil in the world and despite concerns about government debt here in the U.S. and the relative value of the dollar and a possible shutoff of oil shipments from the Middle East. I'm not predicting that necessarily, but with all the turmoil there between Israel and Gaza and other countries in the world, the turning upside down of the country of Iraq, for example, you just never know. You never know when the world supply of oil may get hindered dramatically. That usually causes fluctuations and turmoil on Wall Street. It hasn't happened. Are we to trust that the market continues to perform well over the next, say, few weeks or several months? David Smith from Smith Investment Management, he joins us coming up next to give us some insight, as he's so good with both conventional and unconventional advice on planning for our retirements and building wealth for our individual households. So stand by for that. That's coming up next. Glad you're here. It's 6:08 Central Time. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill.
My savior, my savior.
morning, 6:09. Faith Radio is what you're listening to. I am Austin Hill, and we're glad you're with us. The stock market, the market is making all kinds of new highs, establishing new records, and that's great. That means that if you look at the valuation of your 401k or your stock holdings themselves, maybe certain other kinds of funds and accounts and such, you see the dollar value of what you're holding, and that goes up. But is the value real? And what are we to make of talk from the U.S. Federal Reserve that they may pull back some of their basically their stimulus efforts? They call it quantitative easing. That's a big sophisticated term that economists use, and the Federal Reserve chairperson Janet Yellen uses that. They buy bonds and take those off the market, so stock values rise and play all these games, keep interest rates low and so forth. But that stimulus stuff might come to an end, and it's supposed to come to an end later this fall. Where are we at, and what's the best way forward as we seek to be good stewards of what we got? David Smith is with Smith Investment Management. He advises investors around the country and around the world. He also teaches investment and economics to kids in his church, which is very cool. David Smith, welcome back to the program. How are you, sir?
Well, thank you, Austin. I'm well, and it's always to be a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to spend some time with you.
Well, it's great to be with you. So let's talk about these new highs on Wall Street. You've been watching these more carefully than most, and my goodness, with all the turmoil in the world, I was expecting maybe some selling off, some decline, some sputtering on Wall Street. That hasn't been the case, at least for the last couple of weeks or so. What's going on here as you see it?
Well, the we still have quantitative easing, which is an encouragement for the financial institutions to really support the market, and people are left at the moment with not much choice but equities. Interest rates have been suppressed to levels that encourage very few people to want to be there. Mm-hmm. And so by default, stocks do pay a little bit of a yield, and people are kind of by default herded into the equity markets.
And that makes sense. I mean, that's kind of how I see it as a layperson, David Smith. And yet at the same time, if we are to believe and take seriously remarks made by the chairperson of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, she says that they're going to scale back on some of that quantitative easing, or I just look at it, these are means by which they try to stimulate or provide stimulus to the stock market. She's saying these stimulus to the stock market, they're going to start scaling that back, tapering it off another notch, probably in October. And so I'm looking at that thinking, okay, well, what does that mean? Do interest rates jump up when she scales back the stimulus? Do stock values decline? What sort of shift are we headed to? And what does this mean for loans and banking and getting a mortgage and selling houses, all that stuff? Can you give us your thoughts on that?
Well, sure. The common sense reaction to the Fed buying less or just creating less money is that mm-hmm. interest rates do rise. And if interest rates rise, that puts pressure on mortgage rates, and that pushes real estate down, and that attracts money out of the equity markets. That attracts money out of the stock markets, which is just looking at some kind of yield. And it's hard to come to any conclusion other than real estate and equity markets are heading south when interest rates rise. And if we're to take Chairperson Yellen at her word, then we are expecting that to happen in October, which historically you have to smile a little bit if you've followed the market at all over the last, and any period of time. October is a very difficult month, and it looks like they're going to increase rates in October. So the market is set up for perhaps a very serious sell-off in October.
Sell-off meaning people sell shares, prices, valuations decline, and probably a lot of people lose money in the process.
Indeed.
David Smith is with Smith Investment Management, and he's on our guest line. We'll continue with him in just a moment. More questions for him, and he is fond of saying he advises people with conventional and unconventional wisdom when it comes to planning for their financial futures. And as I said earlier, he teaches that conventional and unconventional wisdom to kids in churches, which, my goodness, if we don't have more people teaching about economics and finance and business in churches soon, well, I'll just put it this way. I'm glad David Smith's doing what he's doing. We'll talk more with him in just a moment. 6:15, it's the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill.
News you can use. Connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the morning.
6:17 on the Faith Radio Network. David Smith with Smith Investment Management on our guest line as we talk about things that may be on the horizon. The stock market, Wall Street, has actually produced new highs in the last several days. And that feels good. But our federal government, vis-a-vis the U.S. Federal Reserve, is saying that they will be scaling back some of the things they do as a means of stimulating stock values. So, David Smith, yesterday, as you probably saw this, there were a couple of financial analysts, investment analysts, I should say, on the CNBC Business News cable channel, and both of them were predicting, in many ways, kind of what you're suggesting could happen. I think you're stating it a little more tentatively. We just don't know what's coming, but it would appear as though some of the stimulus on the stock market is going to be scaled back, and this could create some drops in prices on the stock market. But two guys on CNBC yesterday said this could cause the value of the stock market to decline by more than 50%, maybe even as high as 60%. Those are a couple of voices in the national media. Among a lot of people are saying, hey, buy this and buy that, and oh, this tech stock is going to show great growth, and here's a quick way to make money, and those kinds of things. How do we sort this out? All these competing ideas and prognostications. For the person who's saying, I just want to be faithful with the resources God has blessed me with, and I want to be a good steward, plan for my future and my family's future. In this environment, what's the first couple of steps towards accomplishing that, would you say?
Well, that's a great question, Austin. And for the person, for the Christian who wants to do that, certainly prayer would be the first step. The second step would be to look for ways to ground what they're doing in common sense.
Okay.
Because if you're not going forward in ways that make sense to you, when volatility and sharp price movements happen, you'll be scared out and you'll typically do the wrong thing at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
So, practical things for me, certainly having a cash position which takes care of emergencies for, 3 to 6 months, having minimal amounts of debt, and certainly I do believe that trimming down equity positions, stock mutual funds, and individual stock holdings that have had appreciation in them makes mm-hmm. a lot of sense. And only hanging on to the highest quality names. Something else that people often don't think of, the other side of their balance sheet. You have things that you own and things that you owe. I would really recommend the folks that have adjustable mortgages to see if they can refinance those into 30-year fixed. And the immediate result of that may be they have some larger payments because the fixed rate for 30 years may be more than an adjustable rate that they
sure.
have. But that will protect them. I believe in due course rates rise, and it's just a conservative way to manage your finances, and I think that's important now.
For the last 4 or 5 years, people have been predicting that mortgage lending rates were going to rise dramatically. It hasn't happened, and yet with this stated deadline in essence from the Federal Reserve for October, that by implication would say mortgage interest rates will rise. For the person who's thinking about selling or buying a house right now, what advice do you have?
Well, if a person wants to trade up, let's say they have a home and they want to trade up, I would suggest that they sell before they buy, and not try to just buy what they want, and then with the hopes that they can sell and get the price they want. It's just It removes some of the variables in that transaction. If a person does not have a home or can wait to purchase a second home, I would do so.
Mm-hmm.
I would do so for a quarter or two quarters, and let things shake out a bit. It may be a little bit longer than that. That would be wise to do that. And you know, when you're talking about folks expecting interest rates to rise, I would be in that camp. I've been expecting that and have missed it for some time. But in due course, you know, common sense wins out, and basic laws of finance win out. And
it's almost as though we've got some laws of physics in play as well. You know, I mean, that which goes up must come down, and vice versa. It just seems to me that's the physical world is governed by those kinds of basic properties, and so is the financial world as well.
Exactly, but you know, the frustrating thing, and if you look at this, you know, investing doesn't give you an immediate common sense reaction to an environment. Investing is not like chemistry. You know, in chemistry, every time you bond together two parts of hydrogen, one part of oxygen, you get water, H2O. We learned it when we were young, right? And it happens instantly.
Right.
And investing, you can have one period of time with seemingly one set of rules for 50 years. And then for the next 50 years, it's something different. And that the main thing that gets added to that mix is the political environment.
Yeah, sure. I want to ask you, and by the way, David Smith from Smith Investment Management is on our guest line. We just have a final few moments here, but I want to ask you something about something you said actually when you were with us last time. And I wrote a blog post about David Smith's last appearance here, and you can find that on our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. And I posted it on my personal Facebook page, which I frequently do, and somebody read that, and they were really struck by the fact that you, an investment and portfolio manager, were saying, you know, hey, here's some things you might want to invest in, but among them, you had gold on the list, but you were also saying, now is probably a wise time to kind of rethink what kind of stock you have, so to speak, in your pantry. Do you have a supply of necessary resources in your house in the event that we have some sort of crisis unfold and the supply chains maybe get cut off? And I think you kind of tied that to oil. That's something I'm always watching for with the turmoil in the Middle East. If we had an real energy crisis here in the U.S., well, everything could come to a grinding halt or at least be delayed somewhat. But I had people really struck that an investment manager was saying, hey, try to become more self-sufficient with even basic supplies in your house. What would you say, given this looming deadline in October, what do we need to do just briefly to make sure that our households are going to be functional and operational should there be a little bump in the road and supplies aren't distributed so freely in our country?
Oh, that's a good question, Austin. I think it's always important to have safety valves in place. And, you know, or insurance policies, right? You know, we don't get disappointed if we have fire insurance on our house.
Mm-hmm.
Another year goes by and our house didn't burn down and we didn't collect on that. Well,
sure, right.
You know, having a serious supply of backup water, having a meaningful supply of food, you know, the average home has 3 days of food in it. So, you know, in due course, we have snowstorms, we have earthquakes, we have, you know, plagues, we have, you know, all sorts of things. And, you know, by having a, you know, backup system, having some safety valves in place, it gives us peace of mind. We're not at, you know, it reduces our risk. So,
yeah.
You know, with you know, the tapering thing, with the Ebola thing, with anything, and often the things that are the major bumps in the road are the things that we absolutely do not see coming. So
sure.
I just think it makes sense for anyone, and certainly folks that want to live in peace, to have some safety valves set up.
Makes sense to me. David Smith, SmithInvestmentManagement.com is where you can find him. David, thanks as always. We will watch what happens on Wall Street. I'm sure we'll be watching our portfolios as well, and we'll look forward to talking again soon as we all at the same time try to get out of an adjustable rate mortgage and into a fixed rate. Thanks very much. Good to talk to you this morning.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Good to be with you. It's now 626. It's the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, Connecting Faith. That's our program you hear weekdays at 12 noon. We'll find out what Neil Stavem has coming up on his program next. Listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill, in the house weekday morning, 6 till 8. Not to be too personal, but when was the last time you and your spouse went on a date? Yesterday on Connecting Faith, heard weekdays 12 noon Central Time, Neil Stavem. Welcome Dave and Claudia Arp to the program. They've written a great book. It's called $10 Great Dates. Here's part of that conversation.
As the book, as you described, it's you've got the section, kind of the idea, then before you date, and then on your date, and then the talking points. Talk a little about the before. Is it something where you decide together, you know, that you're planning it out, say, all right, we're going to do, here's where we're going to go, or is it just one of the spouses says, here's an idea for our date night? I guess you set aside a time first, and then just... someone decides then what you're going to do?
Yeah, you could take turns. I mean, you don't have to do it together. You can do it together, but they're just, all the dates are really flexible, and you don't have to do it exactly like we line them up. But we give the idea that gives you the big picture, and then, like, one date that we like is the lobby hopping date.
We live here outside of Washington, D.C.
And we got a lot of great hotels, and so the idea is you visit a hotel lobby and just enjoy the sights and sounds. You watch the people come and go, and you know, it's really fun. And if you want to be a little cheesy, you can actually just meet and flirt and pick each other up in the lobby. But beforehand, you know, one person would research what hotels are in the area and check online for, you know, you can see pictures of the lobbies, pick the more romantic ones, and then just, you know, whatever you need to do beforehand, and one person, you know, can do that, or you can do it together.
And usually the hotels are sort of bunched, so you can go from one lobby to another lobby.
Sure.
And what we sort of enjoy doing is you know, saying, going up and saying, you know, is the honeymoon suite available? You know, we'd like to...
Yeah,
you know,
we may want to come here on our 50th.
Yeah. can we check it out? And it's sort of fun just to go up, you know, see some of these really nice, I mean, really, some of these rooms are really incredible. And, you know, we'd never go there, but it's just sort of fun to think about it.
You know, how, do we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to say, well, if we're having a date, it's got to be special. It's got to be really meaningful.
You know, if you only have one date a year, that would be trivial. You know, if you're trying to have a weekly date, you know, it's just fun. You look forward to the time together, and this book definitely would not put pressure on them. Instead, it would take the pressure away because it gives them the framework and, you know, even gives tips on their date. And then the talking points I especially like because it helps them to stay positive and it helps them not talk about work, their kids, their mother-in-law or whatever. And so, you know, it's just helps them to focus on each other.
Actually, that's a very good point. We, you know, these days are not to talk about your mother-in-law or talk about your finances or to talk about the kids. These are, you agree ahead of time, we're going to go out on a date, we're going to focus on us, and we're going to talk about the talking points and you know, not talk about these other, if you need to talk about those other things, then, you know, have a business meeting.
Sure.
Talk about those and then go out on your great date. But, Neil, one of our phrases that we use a lot is, fun in marriage is serious business.
Dave and Claudia Arp, author of $10 Great Dates, a guest with Neil Stavem on Connecting Faith yesterday. Coming up on today's edition of the program, Neil welcomes David Nasser. David was born in Iran and had to escape the country during the volatile religious revolution back in the late 1970s. And with as much as the Middle East and Iran is in the news today, well, we don't want to miss this. We'll hear his account in great detail. David Nasser with Neil Stavem on Connecting Faith, 12 noon Central Time here at the Faith Radio Network today. It's now 6:31. Good morning and welcome to Thursday. I'm Austin Hill. The news is next.
Back to Austin Hill in the morning. Questions or comments for the show? You can leave them on our show page at myfaithradio.com.
Good morning, 6:36 on the Faith Radio Network. We're glad you're with us. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your support of what we do. Come on board. Join us anytime. Our mobile-friendly website is myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. Coming up after the news at 7 o'clock, we'll talk about some very interesting goings-on with Kim Cotola. She is a host of her own program, Sunday Evenings, here on the Faith Radio Network. But last week she was with us, and she has begun some very interesting new endeavors teaching abstinence, sexual abstinence to teenagers. And the abstinence sex ed movement is something that's been around for a long time. It's ebbed and it's flowed. But you'll have some thoughts on that and where that might be headed coming up after the news at 7 o'clock. Also, 10 days without. Can you go 10 days without? Without what, you're probably asking. Well, you'll meet the author of 10 Days Without. He's got some interesting thoughts on challenging one's Christian faith while living here in a land of plenty called the United States of America. Jesus teaches in the Beatitudes, blessed are the peacemakers. Most of us know that if we've studied the teachings of Jesus and have read the what are commonly referred to as the Beatitudes from the New Testament. But is peacemaking and peacekeeping precisely the same thing? Probably not. In most cases, most people would agree that peacekeeping is something different and not necessarily conducive to peacemaking. But what if you're in a relationship where you're faking as though there is peace? There is such a thing as being a peace faker, so says Leslie Vernick, relationship expert. She joins us now to talk about help for those who are peace fakers. Leslie Vernick, welcome back to the program. Good to talk to you.
Hi, Austin. Good to be back.
As I understand it from your website, you apparently had an inquiry from a listener, a reader of yours. Somebody contacted you and said, hey, I've been in this relationship and I've been faking peace for quite some time. And that touched off an interesting dialogue, and you've got some very interesting insights on what to do about that. What does it mean? Give us a more clear definition. What does it mean when somebody feels as though they're faking the peace in the relationship?
Well, it means that they're not really confronting what's going on. They're not talking about it. They're not setting a boundary, or they're not putting into effect consequences for wrong behavior. But instead, they're just placating or pretending that everything is fine. They're keeping things calm because they're not talking about what's wrong. But they're not really resolving the problem. When the Bible talks about peace, when Jesus says peacemakers, he's talking about a shalom kind of peace, an authentic kind of peace, a true kind of peace. And so oftentimes in marriage, one or the other person knows that there's something wrong, knows there's a conflict, but they're too afraid to talk about it for a variety of reasons. And so instead, they just fake over that and they pretend like it doesn't exist, or they don't want to talk about it, or they ignore it. And then they're peace fakers, or they're peace, you know, makers, not biblical, or peacekeepers, not biblical peacemakers.
Yeah. Leslie, according to what I see, and I think I'm understanding clearly what you've got written on your website, this reader of yours contacted you, and this person apparently had read your new book, The Emotionally Destructive Marriage, and this woman writes, I've been a peace faker for 16 and a half years. I spoke up at year 3 in my marriage, and it didn't go well. I'm now working on a safety plan, but my next step is that there needs to be three questions that you talk about in chapter 9 of your book. And the reader goes on to say that, you know, the questions are pretty challenging to her. I guess a couple of observations I'm making. This poor woman who contacted you, she's been peace faking for 16 and a half years, and things have gotten so bad, she's at the risk for domestic violence, it sounds like. Comment on how these things escalate if we don't address them, if you would, please.
Well, in year 3, when she spoke up and said, you know, whatever was wrong, she didn't go into details on the question, but at year 3 when she said, this isn't good for me and I don't like living this way and what do we need to do to work this marriage out, apparently her husband wasn't open to looking at that. He wasn't open to her feelings. He wasn't willing to take a look at himself. And so when it didn't go well, it just continued to escalate his behavior. And when you're in a domestic violence situation or any kind of abusive relationship, over time, if it's not changed, it increases. It escalates in frequency and intensity. So obviously after year 16, this is getting worse and worse and worse. And by year 16, she's feeling in more danger to be physically hurt or emotionally crushed. And so she's needing to make a safety plan. And so it's really important for women or men who are in a destructive marriage where there's any kind of physical abuse, the first time it happens, that you put down some very specific consequences and boundaries. If not, if it's, you know, leave marriage, because someone has to see right from the beginning that this behavior is so damaging to a relationship that it is unacceptable, and we cannot have peace in our marriage if you act this way.
Leslie Vernick is a relationship expert, a popular speaker. She's with us frequently here on our program. She's a clinical counselor. Her new book is called The Emotionally Destructive Marriage. Now, you apparently get to some three very specific questions, very important questions in Chapter 9 of your book, Leslie. And these were questions that apparently were really very eye-opening and really caused some soul-searching with this lady who contacted you. But where do you start? What's question number one that we should ask ourselves if we find ourselves maybe thinking, gosh, maybe I'm a peace faker and it's just not working out? Where do we start?
Well, one of the things you understand if you're a peace faker is you understand your body. I mean, hopefully you understand that the body doesn't lie. And so when you're constantly feeling like you're ready to throw up in this person's presence, or you can't breathe, or you're shaking, or your heart is pounding, or your stomach is hurting, or your head is aching, you know that your body is saying, there's something wrong in this relationship. And so I think that's really important for the person in a destructive marriage or in any kind of destructive relationship to pay attention to, that your body doesn't lie, and they're telling you, it's something's wrong. We need to correct something. Either you need to correct this relationship, or you need to be out of this relationship because you can't continue to live like this. And I can't tell you the number of women and men often who have had very physically real health problems because they have lived in a relationship that has been toxic to them. So these three questions were really geared toward the destructive, to ask him, not mm-hmm. for her to reflect on herself, for her to ask him. Because part of trying to open up the conversation to bring about peace and to talk about what's wrong opens up these questions. And so when someone asks, for example, are you happy? It begins to open up a dialogue. Can we talk about our relationship?
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about what's wrong? The second question is, what do you see as our most important goal or challenge as a couple if we're going to improve our relationship? That's the second question that someone can ask to bring about true peace, because it opens up the dialogue to truth, gives an opportunity for him to express his feelings, for her to express her feelings. And if she's not ready to do that, or if the person who's been faking it all along is not ready to do that, I give some very important instructions before you ask these questions to build up your own core strength, I call it, so that you can ask these questions in the best possible way. But it opens up that dialogue, and it gives you a chance to see whether your husband or the person you're in this relationship with is willing to reflect on their part. Are they willing to reflect on what's going on in their part of the relationship,
right,
or is it always all your fault?
And one could imagine it, how a very simple question, are you happy, could really make somebody very vulnerable, and that could amount to kind of a scary question in some sense. I presume that's probably a common reaction?
I think it is a scary question, and so when we ask it with the right spirit and in the right strength, it causes someone to reflect on their life. Am I really happy? Am I really happy the way things are between us, even though there's no obvious conflict because I'm always getting my way and I'm demanding that you do everything I want? Is this really what I want? Is this making me happy as a person? Is this the kind of life I want to live? Now, that doesn't always mean that that happens. People don't always stop and reflect, but
mm-hmm.
it gives them the opportunity to do that, yes, and it's a vulnerable question, and if you can ask it with core strength, sometimes you get some real surprising results.
Leslie Vernick, clinical counselor, author, and speaker. She's with us as we talk about the concept, the problem, the dilemma of peace faking. Not peacemaking, but peace faking. We'll talk more with Leslie Vernick in just moments. 646 on the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Stay with us. On the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Did you ever think that you would see the day in the United States of America where the concept of sexual abstinence was controversial? It is just that, especially when abstinence as an idea, as even just merely being introduced, not imposed necessarily, but being introduced to teenagers and young adults. Kim Cotola, host of the Cradle My Heart program, Sunday evenings here on the Faith Radio Network. She joins us after the news at 7 o'clock to talk about the enterprise, the effort towards abstinence education for children. Also, 10 Days Without, interesting book title. We'll meet the author in a little less than half an hour from now. Leslie Vernick is a clinical counselor. She's an author and public speaker, and she's written very eloquently on her website and in her latest book, The Emotionally Destructive Marriage, about this notion of peace faking. Not real genuine peace making, not actual peace, but pretending that there's peace. Let's say I wanted to ask you a little bit. You referenced earlier this notion of true, biblically based, genuine, authentic peace. I don't recall what the Hebrew word was that you used, if it was shalom or whatever it was, but you traced it back to some ancient biblical Old Testament roots. Give us an idea for those of us who are in marriages and maybe we're not so happy. What does genuine peace look like in a good, healthy relationship?
I think peace looks like when two people are honest and authentic and they live with each other's weaknesses and differences in a respectable, reciprocal way. They give each other the freedom to be themselves. And when there's a conflict between them, they work on solving the problem, not attacking each other.
So that is to say that genuine, authentic peace is not a relationship, but that does not mean that the relationship is devoid of conflict.
Absolutely not. There's, you know, we're people. We're going to have conflict. We're going to see things differently. But the way that they solve the conflict is done through mutual respect and freedom to speak into the relationship in a honest way. And when one person isn't free to do that, they're just muzzled, so to speak, because they're afraid of, you know, rocking the boat or, you know, afraid of the consequences of being hit or screamed at. Then they're faking peace by not speaking up because they're afraid to speak up because they're not allowed to speak up.
Now, what would you say, Linda Mitchell, I'm sorry, Leslie Vernick, what would you say to that person who is listening to your description and saying, boy, what she's describing just seems so attractive. I can never get there. That's never going to happen in this relationship. How would you respond to that?
They might be right. It might not ever happen in this relationship. And so then you have some very important decisions to make. How do you want to live in this relationship? Do you want to live as a peace faker? Or do you want to live as a truth teller? And I think the thing that really is really important for those people who are married in this kind of situation is that we've often, you know, valued the sanctity of marriage, but we've compromised truth telling in all of that. We've asked someone to pretend and lie in order to keep the marriage together versus telling the truth and living with the fallout. And I use Abigail as an example here. I mean, she was very truthful about who her husband was. He was a fool. She had no fantasies that he was going to change. But when she met up with David, because he was about ready to attack their family because he was so outraged over Nabal's conduct, she went as a peacemaker, and she told the truth. My husband's a fool. He's made a terrible mistake. She overruled his decision, and she went in attempts to be honest, authentic with David. She spoke into who the man God called him to be, and he caught himself. This third question that I talk about where it says, what kind of father and husband do you desire to be, came out of my study of Abigail, as she knew the kind of person David desired to be, and he wasn't acting like that in the moment. He was acting like a crazy man because he was so mad. She said, you are the future king of Israel. You desire to be a godly man. Think about what you're doing here. And it did cause him to stop and reflect and say, thank you for bringing me to my senses. And she brought about true peace in that relationship between David and her household because of her authenticity, her honesty, and her courage. She didn't know what was going to happen. She didn't know what was going to, you know, happen to her. He could have just killed her too, but she went forward in truth, being a peacemaker, not a peace faker.
And that's where professionals like Leslie Vernick come alongside and enable people to do that. Her new book is The Emotionally Destructive Marriage. We'll have information on this whole notion of being a peace faker, the problem of peace faking. We'll have that on myfaithradio.com and link back to Leslie Vernick and her good work. Leslie, very enlightening. Thank you, as always, for joining us. We appreciate what you do, and we'll read up on the website, and we'll look forward to talking again very, very soon.
Okay, thanks, Austin. Bye-bye.
Good to be with you. Peace faking, it's not the same as peace making. And as I said, we'll make sure to get that at myfaithradio.com. 6:53, Thursday underway. Hope your day is off to a good start and all is well and that you are safe. When we come back, Live the Promise is the program hosted by, well, you know, Susie Larson. Weekday afternoons 3 till 5. We'll find out what's coming up on today's edition of the program next. Good morning. It's the Faith Radio Network. Susie Larson hosts Live the Promise here at Faith Radio, weekday afternoons 3 till 5 p.m. Central Time. And yesterday, Susie was joined once again by marriage and family expert Greg Smalley. They talked about how to love your spouse even during the really, really tough times. Here's part of that conversation.
I think we're shocked when we encounter times in marriage where the winds are blowing and our face is getting slapped with the sleet. I didn't sign up for this, is what you often hear us say. But Jesus did say, you will have trouble. You will have trouble, but you will overcome. You can be of good cheer. So this is a good reason for hope. And Greg, your story doesn't end here, though, does it?
No, you know, when we were at the very top, now, you know, we celebrated. It was so fun, too. I mean, there were so many people that we passed and who had passed us, and we sort of like this big cohort who summited. It took us about 4 hours. It was so shocking to me, the reminder again of the power also. I mean, hope is great. The power, though, of community as well. You know, here we had people, I'd never met them before, and we're exchanging, where are you from? Hey, I'm from here, and hey, keep going, you're going to do it, and pat each other on the back. We get to the top, man, we're all hugging and embracing and high-fiving, and I'm just laughing because I'm like, I'm just going, I don't even know you, and I'm hugging you. Come here, come on in for a hug, bring it in. And you know, and that's so true that Satan wants us alone. He wants us isolated. He wants us to be battered by the wind and the rain and the sleet and, you know, the exhausted muscles and all that. And yet, not only did I get hope, but I had community. I had other people. I had the girls. I contrast that with the girls, when they just want to get out of the windy, snowy, sleety part, and so they're way fat. They're like gazelles, you know. I'm like a tortoise going up and down this thing. And so I said, girls, just go. I mean, get to the tree line, you know, hunker in some of the trees. I'll walk by. We'll start walking again. And I hated every moment of that because now going down was the worst part. It just did such a number on my knees, and I was really hurting big time, and I was alone. And to contrast that with just moments ago, having Murphy, having Taylor, having all these people, you know, keep going, it was absolute misery. And it just, again, solidified that in whatever season you're in, if you're in a sleety, windy, can't see, muscles killing you, knees killing you season in your marriage, you can make it. Hey, we've all been there. There's light. There is a summit. You know, God's there. He's in your corner. I mean, you've got hope, but make sure that you've got a community of who are encouraging you, who are there walking with you, who are there to. It's not even the advice. You know, I'm sure there was better technique that I could have employed. There were probably smarter ways to clothe myself. You know, there's probably a lot that let me say this. I've learned a lot about how to do that differently, but that will never take away from the power of having hope and having community.
Family counselor Greg Smalley, a guest with Susie Larson on her program Live the Promise, weekday afternoons, 3 till 5 p.m. Central Time here on the Faith Radio Network. Coming up this afternoon, Susie welcomes philosopher Dr. Oz Guinness. He'll join her on the program to discuss his latest book, Renaissance. That's a good one. It gets underway this afternoon at 3 o'clock Central Time here on the Faith Radio Network. It's now 6:58, Thursday morning underway. Hope it's off to a good start for you. I'm Austin Hill, and thank you for listening. Weekday morning, 6 till 8. The news is on the way next as we continue. Do you understand how controversial the idea of sexual abstinence is in our culture today? Well, if you do, now imagine trying to teach abstinence as a valid and worthy lifestyle to teenagers. Kim Katoa, host here at Faith Radio, she does just that when she's not behind the microphone. We'll talk about that coming up next. I'm Austin Hill. This is the Faith Radio Network.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Well, good morning, 7:04. Welcome to Thursday, and welcome to the Faith Radio Network. Thank you for being here. I am Austin Hill. I'm here weekday morning, 6 till 8, as we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful as you get your day started. Have you seen or heard any of the news headlines about the rate of unwanted teen pregnancies declining? Yes, there's actually been a decline in that, believe it or not. At the same time, when was the last time you heard anybody talk about abstinence-only education? Do you realize just how abstinence-only sex education, that is? Even the idea of introducing sexual abstinence as a possible option, do you realize how controversial that is? Kim Cotola, host of the Cradle My Heart program, Sunday evenings here at the Faith Radio Network. She joins us momentarily. She's with us most every Thursday here on this program, and she'll talk to us about both of those issues. Also, coming up later this hour, 10 days without. Can you go 10 days without? Well, without once, you're probably wondering, right? It's very interesting. Wouldn't you say it's a rather provocative book title? What does that mean? It gets you wondering, right? It provokes thoughts. You meet the author of 10 Days Without. He is a man from the Nashville, Tennessee area who, I guess, as I read it and as I understand it, this gentleman felt as though he was living in relative comfort and convenience and said, I want to put my Christian faith to the test. So I'm going to go 10 days without. We'll find out exactly what that means coming up in just about half an hour from now. And did you hear about the university professor who banned the expression, bless you, in his classroom? That's not a joke. We had this incident that we've referenced a few times, this incident that kind of popped up in the news over the last couple of weeks about a high school senior, a young lady who's in high school in the state of Tennessee, who was chastised and actually suspended from her public school because somebody in class sneezed and she, the student, said, bless you. And teacher stepped in and said, you're out of school, you're suspended for a day or whatever it was because we don't allow that religious rhetoric in class. Well, that drew quite a controversy, as you would imagine, there in the local public school district in the state of Tennessee. Now a university professor in the Atlanta, Georgia area is saying that if you use the expression, bless you, in my class, I will downgrade your test scores. Isn't that interesting? What's the state of free speech? And if expressions as benign as bless you, which certainly could have a Christian connotation to it, but it's probably more of a colloquialism these days. Maybe if you say bless you, you intend to impart God's blessing in some sense, and that's just fine. But bless you is just so common and so colloquial, if you will. I wonder if we continue down this trajectory here in the United States of America of being relatively ambivalent and doing nothing and being passive in the face of authority figures like university professors, university and college presidents, maybe governors, mayors, school district superintendents. If we remain passive in the face of authority figures, denying us the right to say something as simple as bless you, well, I wonder, will we ever seek to get involved again in the making of the rules that we have to live by? Is public policy and the rules that govern our society, are those things that Christians really want nothing to do with? Are they so undesirable that we have to remain detached from them at all costs? I think this bless you controversy gives rise to some very interesting questions. We'll talk about those and more coming up later this hour. It's now 7:08. When we come back, let's check in with Kim Cotola. We always appreciate her contributions to our program. She is a host, a prolific writer. She is heard every Sunday evening here on the Faith Radio Network. Talk about a decline in unwanted pregnancies among teenagers in the U.S., yes, believe it or not, and the controversy, the alleged controversy of abstinence education. We'll do that coming up next. Stay with us.
Getting your day started, connecting faith to life. Back to Austin Hill in the morning.
Good morning, 7:09 on the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your support of Faith Radio. We welcome and invite and request your support anytime at myfaithradio.com. Abstinence, it's the A word, I guess, in the minds of some, and it's a word to be avoided. Imagine actually entering into a public school classroom, really anywhere in the U.S., and saying, I'd like to talk to you students about sexual abstinence, not engaging in any kind of sexual activity. Maybe this is presented as the only way to go. Maybe it's just presented as an idea. Well, just simply proposing the idea that one can be sexually abstinent is in the minds of some very controversial. Kim Cotola, host of the Cradle My Heart program, Sunday evenings here on the Faith Radio Network. She joins us now. Kim, welcome back to the program. Good to talk to you.
Hey, Austin. Good morning.
You know, it was almost sort of a cliffhanger the last time we talked to you last Thursday. You kind of threw that in at the end of the program. You said, well, I'm beginning to teach abstinence in public high schools in my area. And then we had to wrap up the program and move on. And I thought, well, my goodness, that's very interesting. Let's follow up on that. Tell us what got you started and even being interested in teaching abstinence to high school students.
Well, I've been active in the pregnancy health movement for over 10 years, giving my testimony of God's healing after abortion and helping people to understand that it's just a choice that no one should make. And simply because, well, as someone once said, no one has the right to do what's morally wrong. But, you know, after a while, if you see so many people broken by abortion, there are many of us who are saying, let's get busy on prevention. You know, let's help people avoid this circumstance that I found myself in to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And so many in the pregnancy help movement are very active now in training for abstinence. And there's a local center that I'm involved with, and they said they needed volunteers and prayed about it. And so I got trained, and I'm enjoying the experience very much.
That's very interesting. Is this in the minds of some a controversial thing to simply introduce abstinence as a lifestyle option? I'm guessing you're probably clear on where you stand, what you believe is correct, but in public schools, abstinence is probably, if it's allowed to be discussed at all, it's probably presented only as one of many options. But is that controversial in the minds of some?
Well, it's controversial in that it had received some public funding. And so people said, you know, this is irresponsible because kids are going to be sexually active. So if you're just going to go in and tell them don't do it, and you're not going to tell them how to avoid STDs, how to avoid pregnancy, it's an irresponsible approach. In other words, those who would oppose it say kids aren't capable of it. Young adults, you know, kids and young adults are not capable of abstinence. They're not capable. And so I think that's where the controversy resides, that if we're going to adopt it as policy, is it really an effective and responsible policy?
What sort of results does abstinence-only education produce in your mind?
Well, it's interesting. You know, knowing we were going to talk about this, Austin, I did a little bit of research, and the program that I'm actually trained in is called Choosing the Best. It's research or evidence-based, and there's a distinction there when you start talking about abstinence, because are you teaching values, or are you saying, you know, what is the science? Is there any evidence of what you're teaching? And in Choosing the Best, this is a program that's been endorsed by a former director of the CDC, Dr. William Roper, and it's being used in many public high schools and high school systems. And there was a study done in North Carolina recently in a county that had a teen pregnancy rate in 2008 of 318 pregnancies. That's for 15 to 19-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Choosing the Best was implemented, and it's a one-week program which is given in the physical education class in ninth grade, when that was adopted and they circled back in 2012, there was a 37% reduction in the number of teen pregnancies. And so, I mean, that's pretty dramatic. And what I've been able to glean from this and from looking at some other research is it's just like in our homes. You cannot sit your child down and say, here's the story of the birds and the bees. Now, be responsible until marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to continually be having conversations, reinforcing, looking for teachable moments, making sure that they feel well loved and that they're not looking for love and gratification in the wrong places. It's not a one and done. And so if the culture of a high school and a community is reinforcing what the children are learning in school and in this program, then you're going to see your very best outcomes.
Kim Cotola, she is a host Sunday evenings at 8 p.m. She hosts Cradle My Heart. That's the name of the program. She's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network, talking about abstinence education, teaching sexual abstinence to teenagers and young adults. We'll continue with her in just moments. 7:15, you're on the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. On the Faith Radio Network. Good morning and welcome. I'm Austin Hill. It's Thursday. It's underway. Hope it's underway for in a good way for you. Kim Cotola hosts the Cradle My Heart program Sunday evenings here on the Faith Radio Network. She is actively involved in the quest for a truth about the essence and the sanctity of life. She teaches about healing in the aftermath of an abortion. She's also engaged in teaching sexual abstinence to underage minors, to young adults, to teenagers. And Kim, it occurs to me that for some, the idea of teaching abstinence may sound a little quirky or a little odd. In other words, abstinence involves something that you don't do. How do you teach somebody about something that you don't want them to do? I know there's a lot to it, actually, but give us an idea of what you're engaged in as an instructor.
We simply give them the facts, and we say to them, you know, here's what's happening with your developing body. Here's what will happen if you make these choices. If you stay abstinent, you will not contract a sexually transmitted disease, and you have zero risk of becoming pregnant. If you make that choice to become sexually active, even short of intercourse or vaginal intercourse, forgive me, but the language gets very frank with the ninth graders.
Sure.
You know, even if we're talking about sexual activity involving sexual parts. So, you know, here are the consequences if you make that choice, and we present the evidence to them and help them choose the best. You know, and often, you know, as we were talking in the beginning, I thought about a student in one class who raised the objection, and you know, there's always that one ninth grader who stands out, looks like he's already shaving, and he's a head taller than everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was that young man. And he said, this is crazy, and, you know, this is, again, he raised that objection. This is not responsible. You're not telling kids who want to make the choice how to protect themselves. You're not saying anything about contraception or, you know, preventing STDs, et cetera. And I was very grateful that the instructor stepped in and said, you know, to the young man, look, this is what the state of Georgia has found to be the very best information that young people need to arm themselves with staying healthy. This is a health class. And if you make a choice, you know where you can find information about all those other things. Every kid does.
Mm-hmm.
But we are trying to educate you about what the very best choice is.
That's very interesting. Good that you have that kind of support, I would say.
Well, I love the analogy on the flip side, too, for those who say what we need to do is teach kids responsible sexual behavior. Someone said that's like saying, you know what, every child is fascinated with fire. So at about age 5, 6 or younger, when they become interested in playing with matches, we need to give every child a pair of asbestos gloves. That will keep them safe.
That's right. Practicing safe fire. That's just absurd, the thought of it. Kim Cotola from her Sunday evening program here on the Faith Radio Network. She's with us now. To your point about some of the very frank discussions of sexual activity other than, as you put it, vaginal intercourse. I'm wondering, amid some of these new statistics that show that the rate of unwanted teen pregnancies has in some regions of the country actually been declining, is that because students, young adults, aren't engaging in vaginal intercourse, but they're still nonetheless participating in other kinds of sexual activities that still put them at risk for diseases and emotional damage and those kinds of things? Give us your thoughts on that, if you would.
Well, there is some evidence that that's true, and we can see it from the rise of sexually transmitted diseases outside of the genital area, so oral herpes. And, you know, any sexually transmitted disease that you could contract, you can contract orally.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and we are seeing increases there. And, you know, to tell young people that there's no risk and there's no danger and nothing wrong with engaging in those behaviors outside of a committed marital relationship is the height of irresponsibility. And the kids are the ones who are bearing the consequence of that teaching.
Sure. Kim, what advice would you offer to somebody who perhaps wants to engage these kinds of discussions and this kind of instruction in the context of their church? Maybe it's not in school so much, whether it's public or private school, either one, but they're of the mind that, hey, we need to be having these kinds of frank discussions with kids in the church youth group. What's the starting points for that?
There are Christian curricula. There's True Love Waits, and there are others. I think what needs to happen is for an ongoing dialogue. As I said, Austin, we need to, yes, start even younger than ninth grade, because I saw a statistic that said the average kid first sees online pornography at age 8 these mm-hmm. days, and I'm guessing that's probably even, you know, it's probably even younger than that. But so we need to get to them early, and it needs to be an ongoing conversation that stays age appropriate. Because, you know, most of the outcomes that we see that are positive for choosing the best, other curricula like it, is that it delays the onset of sexual debut, which is a good thing. But, you know, if that's all we're doing, and then a young person arrives at age 18 or 19 and launches from home without a very strategic and well thought out plan for mm-hmm. how they're going to manage the freedom in college, we really have not done them a service after all. And that's, in fact, what happened to me. And that's what we see with abortion. It's not a teen problem, primarily. It's a young adult problem. People in their 20s who, they had a plan for when they were younger. But if we're delaying marriage out until our late 20s, early 30s these days, what is our plan for managing, you know, that aspect of our lives in that long phase until marriage?
Sure. Kim Cotola.
The church could be doing a lot on that score.
I would concur with that. Kim Cotola hosts Cradle My Heart Sunday evenings at 8 p.m. You'll hear her. We will hear her again this Sunday evening. Kim, as always, thanks so much for joining us. Thanks for what you do. We look forward to speaking again, and we'll be listening Sunday night.
True pleasure. Thanks, Austin.
Always great to be with you. 7:24 on the Faith Radio Network. Breakpoints. Breakpoints. What do you think of when you hear breakpoint? Insights, wisdom, some challenging thoughts. You'll hear breakpoint next here on Faith Radio. On the Faith Radio Network. Good morning and welcome. I'm Austin Hill. I'm your weekday morning 6 till 8, where we talk about things that truly do matter. We seek to connect faith to life. Imagine going 10 days without. You may be asking, well, you know, 10 days without what? Think about that. Just imagine what that would involve, being 10 days without any of a number of things. My next guest, actually, is a gentleman who decided to put his faith to the test. He's from the Nashville, Tennessee area, and living apparently in the comforts and confines of the United States of America, he said, maybe I should go through some self-imposed sacrifices and see what my faith is about. Daniel Ryan Day, he is on our guest line. He's the author of 10 Days Without. Daniel, welcome to our program, sir. Good to talk to you.
Hey, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
What led you to do 10 Days Without? We'll find out what you went without in a moment here. But beyond what I just said there in the introductory remarks, what prompted this?
Yeah, so, you know, my story is very similar to many other stories, I'm sure, of people listening, and that is that I grew up in a Christian home and went to a Christian school and church, but I always struggled with the question of what does it look like to live out my faith every day of every month of every year. And one day I was reading in Matthew chapter 25 where Jesus describes these people that really get it, that they understand the gospel, And they're people that give food to the hungry and drinks to the thirsty and provide clothes for the naked and visit the prisoner and take care of those who are sick. And I realized that I wasn't doing any of those things. And so one of the reasons I felt a disconnect between what I said I believed and the way that I was living my life was because there was a disconnect. I wasn't doing some of the simple commands that Jesus teaches. And so I tried to think of a creative way to do that. And I enjoy writing and kind of doing things that are maybe a little bit outside of the box.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came up with the concept of 10 Days Without, to go without something, write about it, and then raise money or collect items or recruit volunteers to go and help those people that Jesus talks about in Matthew 25.
So when we talk about the admonitions of Christ in that section of the book of Matthew, we're talking about at least part of the story is people who are without. The prisoner is without their freedom, their liberty. The person who is thirsty is without water, without drink. The person who is hungry is without food. Where did you begin constructing a list of things to go without? How did you get started, and what did you do without?
Yeah, so I started with the list that Jesus gives in Matthew 25. And, you know, what really jumped out at me is exactly what you said, that those are people that go without. And I realized, you know, we live in a culture of with. And if we were to go without, what would that look like? Because it would be very countercultural. And so I started with something simple. I kind of borrowed from Tom's shoes a little bit and started with 10 Days Without Shoes. And during that time did a lot of research on the 300,000 kids around the world that don't have shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And then just kind of went from there, decided to go 10 days without legs to raise money for and recruit volunteers for Johnny and Friends to talk about people who are affected by disabilities, 10 days without human touch for people affected by slavery, 10 days without speech, and so each one was directly related to some cause that I saw in the world and an opportunity to help those people.
Daniel Ryan Day, his book is called 10 Days Without. He's describing what this process was to write the book and to experience doing without. He's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network. Tell us about the 10 Days Without Legs. I presume that means that you simply didn't walk anywhere for 10 days. Tell us what you did, what you didn't do, and what your experience was like.
I'm sure most people can imagine how difficult it is for someone with two good legs to go without using my legs. And I remember the first morning that I woke up for this experiment. And, you know, I went to jump out of bed and then realized, okay, I can't do that. And so I kind of rolled out of bed instead. And then I grabbed my pants to go to work. And I was trying to figure out, how am I going to put my pants on without using my legs? And it was just a really funny morning. Of course, my wife was very supportive and laughed at me the whole morning as I was trying to figure this out. And so we ended up borrowing a wheelchair from a ministry in town, and people drove me to and from work, and I learned how to navigate a wheelchair for 10 days. And it was very difficult, but it also really opened up my eyes to not only what it means for a building to be handicap accessible,
mm-hmm.
but it also just gave a deep awareness and compassion for people that don't have life as easy as I do. And, you know, we complain about things that are in our lives that often we don't really need to complain about because our lives are pretty good. And that's what I found to be the case for me, too.
You say that you went 10 days without legs, if I understood you correctly, Daniel, to raise awareness about the outreach of the organization run by, I believe it was Johnny Erickson Tada. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
For those who are unfamiliar with her, and she's just an extraordinary person who's been very high profile in the Christian community really ever since I was in elementary school, quite frankly, but tell us a little bit about her background.
Yeah, so she is an artist. One day she dove off of a bridge into a river and ended up hitting the bottom or hit a rock, I can't remember which, in the river and became a quadriplegic, can't use her arms or legs, and she's been in a wheelchair ever since, and that happened to her when she was very young. And so she actually created an entire ministry that does so many amazing things. They provide wheelchairs for people around the world that can't afford wheelchairs for themselves, especially in a lot of third world countries. You know, for me, it was easy. I just looked up a local ministry in town and was like, hey, do you have a few wheelchairs laying around that I could use? And they're like, yeah, of course we do. And so it's easy for me to find one, even for just a silly little experiment. But they're going into these third world countries where people can't afford wheelchairs, and they're providing wheelchairs for them. Those wheelchairs are actually assembled by people, by female prisoners in prison in the United States, which is a pretty neat story as well. Mm-hmm. They also do these camps all around the country to help the moms and siblings and caretakers who every single day take care of someone affected by disabilities, whether it's a physical disability all the way to very severe mental and emotional disabilities. In fact, I was able to go to one of the camps. It was one of the most life-changing experiences that I've ever had. And I was hanging out with this guy, Bryce, who's in a very similar situation to Johnny. And him and I just became the best friends. He has autism as well. He's in a wheelchair. And we just had so much fun that week. And so I would encourage anybody that doesn't know more about Johnny and friends to look it up today.
Hmm. Daniel Ryan Day, his book is called 10 Days Without. Now, we will hold a drawing here in a few moments to give away a copy of his book, so stand by for that. Daniel, I'll tell you what, we need to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to have you tell us about your experience going 10 days without words, without speech, without speaking. So stand by for that. We'll continue with Daniel Ryan Day in just moments. His new book, again, is 10 Days Without. A very, very thought-provoking title, and even as he describes this, you can imagine the internal change that could be engendered in one. We'll talk about it more in just a moment. 7:44 now. This is Faith Radio. I'm Austin Hill. It's 7:46. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Daniel Ryan Day is my guest. He's author of a new book called 10 Days Without, and he's explaining exactly the concepts behind the book and what transpired when he sought to go 10 days without several different things. As a matter of fact, if you'd like to win a copy of the book, you can call us right now on our talk line and enter a drawing. We'll draw a winner for this coming up after the top of the hour into the 8 o'clock hour. But here's our number. It's 877-933-2484. 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. Go ahead and call, and you can just verbally give us your name and enter the drawing. We'll draw a winner after the top of the hour. Daniel Ryan Day, tell us about your experience going, I believe you said, 10 days without words. What happened with that?
That was one of the most difficult ones that I did by far, especially from an emotional standpoint. And, you know, words give us power. Words are our ability to influence people, to communicate our point of view, to stand up for ourselves. And when either you go without those on purpose or when it's intentionally taken away from you, like it is for the 27 million slaves around the world that are still in bondage, it's amazing how it strips you of that power. It strips you of that ability to stand up for yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to go without speech to not only raise awareness, but to raise money for to pull people out of slavery. And the trick for me with that is that I had, at the time, two little kids. I have three now, but at the time I had two little kids, and so I was trying to find ways to still communicate love and affection for them and for my wife without using words, which was pretty difficult. But I also carried around a whiteboard, and a pen so that anywhere I went, I could, communicate with people, whether it was at a coffee shop or in Walmart or anywhere that I needed to communicate with someone.
Very interesting.
It was very powerful. In fact, the most powerful thing that happened during that experiment was we had a huge fire here in Colorado Springs, and the fire swept through the whole mountain, and it was while I was going through that experiment. And I remember watching the fire and thinking about how in James it talks about how our tongues, a tongue used unwisely is like a spark that can bring down a whole forest.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, our words are power. Our words give us not only the opportunity to influence other people, but they give us an opportunity to encourage others, but we can also tear those people down. And so not only was it an opportunity to raise money to pull people out of slavery, but it ended up being an internal lesson to me of the power of language, the power of using our words for people's good and not to harm them.
Daniel, I'm wondering what you would say to the person who's listening to this and saying, wow, this is really amazing, this is provocative, I'd like to try this experiment sometime. But then when you talk about going 10 days without speech, without using your legs, 10 days denying yourself of this freedom or that freedom or that luxury or whatever, at that point we're thinking to ourselves, I don't even get 10 days away from my job or away from my work on an annual basis. How in the world would I budget 10 days to do an experiment? What would you say to that person who would like to experience this, but they're just not sure how you manage the time?
Yeah, let me answer that this way. You know, on the last segment, we talked about how we live in a culture of with, and going without really can change our lives. And so if you start with just a day, go a day without something, whether it's food, and you know, you could just do a fast like we see in the Old Testament or the New Testament, or whether it's going without something like shoes or something like that. Going a day without or a weekend without something can be powerful as well, because we live in a culture where we believe that more is merrier, bigger is better, where wealthiness is next to godliness. We live in that culture of with. And so just breaking out of that culture a little bit can change our perspective. And so I understand that not everybody can go 10 days without some of these things. And if people read the book, they're going to find that there's a few times I messed up, and or as happened in the 10 days without furniture chapter, I ended up at my sister's wedding, and I found that, hey, if I do this, if I don't sit on chairs, I'm going to be a big distraction from what's going on, and this is about my sister, not about me.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we don't want that legalism of trying to, okay, 10 days, I got to hit 10 days to get in the way of us loving people. And of us doing the things that we need to do. And so go a day without, go a weekend without. Look for opportunities just to break out of that rhythm of with that we have in our culture, and it'll begin to change your life.
Just real quick, what did you learn about God's provision as you very intentionally denied yourself of resources and opportunities?
I realized that God has provided more for me than I ever realized. There was a time, actually it's pretty common in my life to kind of mope and think about all the things I don't have. And I remember one day that hit me heavier than it ever had before. And the Lord just kind of whispered to my heart, hey, what if you walked around your house and thanked God for everything that you see? And you just thanked me. And I did that. And it got really annoying very quickly because I had so many things to be thankful for. So it just takes that little bit of gratitude and that little bit of thankfulness to change our perspective, and we'll realize how much we really do have.
And that is saying a lot. Daniel Ryan Day, his book is called 10 Days Without. He's been describing for us the process, the experience of going 10 days without his legs, denying himself the opportunity, the freedom to walk, 10 days without words. chapter by chapter, he goes through self-denial of a variety of sorts and explains all that he learned from that. 10 Days Without is the book title. We will draw a winner for a copy of that coming up after the top of the hour, 8 o'clock. Daniel, thanks, as always, for joining us. I look forward to engaging in this conversation again. Very fascinating experience, and your words, your use of your empowering words today certainly have been very eye-opening and thought-provoking. Thanks for moving us along a little bit in our journey. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Good to talk with you. Daniel Ryan Day, author of 10 Days Without. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. It's 7:54. The Faith Radio Network is on. Thank you for your support of what we do. We are fully listener-supported. No government grants here. Of course, we don't sell advertising. And we appreciate your support. If you've thought about coming on board as a supporter, we welcome that. We humbly and gratefully welcome that. Get to myfaithradio.com for all the info about how to get started with that. And by the way, I mentioned this earlier in the week. It bears repeating. We have, when you go to myfaithradio.com, just log on to our homepage, one of the first things you'll see is a slide. We call it a slide in website land. Slide pops up on the screen telling you that we are giving away a brand new iPad, a brand new Apple iPad. And that is really some extraordinary technology to have at your fingertips. If you've ever used an iPad, if you own one, you know the capabilities that you have with an iPad in front of you really are extraordinary, and you can do some tremendous things. We're giving away one of these. We had a listener, a supporter of Faith Radio, come to us and say, hey, if I gave you this, could you give this away to listeners? And could you use this giveaway item as a means of developing more financial support, encouraging people to come on board? Well, the truth of the matter is, ethically and legally, we cannot require you to donate to Faith Radio in exchange for the privilege of entering the drawing. It's a drawing. It's open to anybody. But I do hope you'll get to myfaithradio.com, take a look at this iPad, and enter the drawing, yes, but seriously consider supporting us. And just understand that this beautiful, top-of-the-line piece of technology here, that somebody very sacrificially donated that to us, and that's why we're able to extend it to you, the opportunity to win it, to you, the listener. And in a similar way, we ask for your support as well. So myfaithradio.com is our place in cyberspace. Coming up tomorrow on this program, Austin Hill in the Morning, Eugene Cho, Seattle-based pastor with a new book out called Overrated. Well, what do you suppose is overrated? What possibly could be overrated in our midst? We'll find out from Pastor Cho about that coming up on tomorrow's program. Also, our great friend George Frazier, he's co-host of Real Recovery, the talk program that gets gut-level honest, sometimes so honest when it's broadcast on Sunday afternoon. Sometimes the Real Recovery program is so honest it's a little unnerving and a little uncomfortable for some. But George Frazier is a co-host of that program where they talk about recovery programs of a variety of sorts that lead people out of addictions of all types, destructive behaviors of all types, sexual problems, drug problems, alcohol problems, pornographic problems. Real Recovery, George Frazier joins us coming up tomorrow to talk about the recovery movement and then some. Also, we will review an issue that came up here on this program earlier this week with a particular interview guest that was with me here on the program just a couple of days ago. This gentleman who writes for World Magazine had some very interesting criticisms of contemporary Christian music and commercially produced worship music. And I'm not of the mind that the CCM world or the worship music publishing industry is entirely above critique and criticism. There's nothing at all wrong with taking a serious look at those kinds of things. But we'll talk about whether the criticisms were valid or not. We'll get to that coming up tomorrow. Have a great day. I'm Austin Hill. See you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. For more information about this, you can visit Austin Hill in the Morning, our program page, on MyFaithRadio.com. That's MyFaithRadio.com.